Welcome everyone to my Wellness Spring podcast show. Today I'm joined by the dynamic Hamish McKay, a true pioneer in biodynamics and one of the original voices who helped to reshape how we grow food, nourish the soil, and understand our connection to the earth and cosmos. In this conversation, we'll explore biodynamics in simple, practical terms, dive into soil, spirituality, reincarnation, and the cosmic rhythms behind the astro calendar. We'll also hear stories from his remarkable journey since the 1970s. This is an inspiring chat, mind-opening. You won't want to miss. This is an inspiring, mind-opening chat that you won't want to miss. Welcome, Hamish, to Wellness Springs Show. It is so lovely to chat with you here.
Thank you. Awesome.
And Hamish, my first questions, because I have many, I thought I would start simply but powerfully. What, in your words, does biodynamics mean?
Well, it's an interesting question, because it was a name given to the work that Rudolf Steiner did. He didn't come up with that name. So it arises out of the eight lectures that Rudolf Steiner gave in 1924 in Kobowitz, which is now in Poland. And that arose out of a number of what you might call leading or more particularly astute farmers who noticed that the traditional, what you might call peasant farming methods, were not what they used to be. And by the time you get to the beginning of the 20th century, Justus von Liebig's work was 60, 70 years old, which was actually quantifying agriculture in a material, its material aspects, which is very necessary work. And again, by adding chemicals, according out of that scientific paradigm, these what I call astute farmers recognized that they weren't getting the results that they needed. So knowing a number of them knew of and knew Rudolf Steiner, so they asked him to give these lectures, which was quite a hard ask to get him to actually do it, but he did it. And he gave a set of lectures that was totally outside the square, so to speak, of contemporary thinking in his day. And it became known as biodynamics a few years later because it's to do with the life activity in agriculture, the life dynamics. Not just the substances, which are important, but actually the life dynamics that attach to it. So it's to do with that's where the name came from. And it's still problematic for a lot of people today. And when I teach it or do workshops, etc., I certainly don't see myself as a salesman. It's more, there are people. An increasing number of people arriving on the planet that, like the farmers of Steiner's day, realized that the existing paradigm is not going to get us to where we need to get to. So there are people looking for a different paradigm, asking the ideas in front of such people so that they can pick them up and make them their own, so to speak. It's not very definite starting points, but they're only starting points. So and the major difference between biodynamics and all the other regenerative and organic and permaculture and all the different approaches, which are all important contributors to where we're trying to get to, but what biodynamics brings in that the others have not yet sort of picked up on is that the everything is actually influenced by the planets and the wider cosmos. So Steiner says that everything is actually influenced by the big picture stuff. If you just focus on the micro, you'll miss the important message in nature, so to speak. So that's where the name sort of came. And as I say, to me, it's if I want to simplify it, I say we're harvesting the cosmos, whereas nearly all the other agricultural approaches are actually trying to harvest the soil or build the soil, which is important, but it's one part of the dynamic.
I love the way you said we're harvesting the cosmos. And I know on your website you've got an astrology chart. Do you want to unpack that for us?
Okay, it's astronomy, not astrology. They're two different sciences, and the astronomy is the difference is astronomy is where the stars and planets and constellations all are physically in the sky. Astrologically, it's not the same thing. It's as I understand it, 2,000 years ago they aligned, but now they're about 23 degrees out of alignment, so to speak. And so astronomy has to do, if you like, with the physical embodiment of the earth and human beings, and the astrology is more to do with the soul nature of human beings. That's my understanding of the difference. So we in Steiner's description, where the human being has four sheaths on the planet, so to speak. We have a physical body, which we share with the mineral kingdom. We then have an etheric body, which is a body of formative force, a shaping body, so to speak, and that we share with the plant kingdom. And then we also have what is described as an astral body or an emotional body, a body that carries all our sympathies and antipathies. And that we share with the animal kingdom. And then on top of that, each human being has their own individual I am that is has dominion over those four sheaths, or has the potential of having dominion over those four sheaths. There are three higher sheaths that we don't yet have, which are called life spirit. Spirit self, life spirit, and spirit man. And they're sort of nascent. They're like seed forces in our being that individuals can awaken and utilize, but most of us are doing battle, trying to master our ego, yeah,
I
our
totally agree with that.
individuality. And the
Yeah,
thing about
I've done it.
the times we live in is that since the 15th century, since 1413, humanity has moved into a new stage of development or evolutionary potential. And increasingly, since 1413, humanity, each individual human, will attempt to become more individual, and that's healthy. The problem is that the more we become individual, it tends to make us antisocial. Yeah, it comes with the territory. The more individual you are, by nature, you become more antisocial. Then we have to actually, using our I am, our ego, we have to pick up our individuality and then choose to be social. And that's the challenge of humanity at this point of time. And just going back to the astronomy part, I mentioned 1413 in the 15th century, and that is the time when the sun moved from being in front of Aries to being in front of Pisces. And if you look at the whole Greco-Roman culture, that happened while the sun was in Aries, the ram. And so in that period, you get the Lamb of God story appearing, so to speak. And then if you go back, that began in 747 BC. If you go back before that, you get to the Egypto-Chaldean time, and that was when the sun was in Taurus. And so you find the whole cult and gesture of the culture of the Egyptian time was different again now. And I suppose I should say that also part of Steiner's work, and as a sort of background or an assumption, or is that human beings reincarnate. And again, if you go back to the New Testament, you can find where it's actually articulated quite clearly. But the church, sometime later, I think around the 4th century, sort of banned the idea of reincarnation. And so you find the church does not acknowledge or teach reincarnation, which, like so many of these things, was appropriate at that time. So things, this is one of the huge challenges. It's a bit like what's right for a 6-year-old and what's right for a 13-year-old and a 20-year-old and a 40-year-old and a 70-year-old is different, because we're at different stages of a development. And so it's not helpful to teach a child to read or write too young, so to speak. And it stultifies their potential. And even in my own school days, those guys who were the fast developers, so to speak, either in intellectual capacities, but more particularly in physical capacities, they in a way stopped developing earlier. So the slower those kids developed, the longer they kept developing, so to speak. And so that's a little bit how it is with humanity. There are various attempts along the way to speed up the process, so to speak. And that can be very detrimental. So these things have their time and place, and the time and place is now to become an individual. But as I say, that makes us antisocial. And so now we have to work out how we choose to be social.
Wow, that's an interesting way of looking at things, because a lot of spiritual people I've been talking to saying now is the time for community and unity and coming together as one. And I'd like to hear your thoughts on that.
That's one of these situations where that I concur with that, but the problem is we first have to be an individual. And in a lot of the, like coming out of the 60s, there was a lot of community and all that sort of stuff. But it's essentially a lot of individuals suffered badly in those communities. Yeah, they were ideological, and essentially a lot of them basically replicated the system that they were opposed to, or they were trying to escape, so to speak. Yeah, so it comes back to we have to become more individual, then we have to find a way to be social. Now, on this score, Rudolf Steiner's one of his greatest contributions is what is termed the threefold social order. And it's on the one hand quite simple, but the application is quite challenging. So Rudolf Steiner sort of looked at the human being, and within each individual human being, we have a number of dynamics going on. I've described four. We also have three systems that we depend on. One's a nerve sense system, and that has its own laws or lawfulness. We have a metabolic limb system which operates under a different lawfulness, and then we have a rhythmic system which operates under a different lawfulness again. So each human being has these three bodies cohabiting the same physical space. And just in very simple terms, if you want to use your nerve sense system, i.e., your thinking, your brain, it's normal for most people. You need to sit quiet and be still. And so, think of people meditating. That to meditate, you've actually got to, your whole nerve sense system has to be quietened till it becomes a receptor. So that's the part that we have to think there. The metabolic limb system, on the other hand, never stops. If you've ever had a partner who's open to it and you put your ear on their stomach when they're sound asleep, their metabolic system is really cranking, even though their head system is totally asleep. So one pole is needs to be stationary to be effective, but the other pole needs to be active all the time. So there are two polarities, and in the middle is our rhythmic system. And if you watch your dam behind you there on a really still morning or evening, it's like glass. Then you get a little bit of breeze and you get ripples. So when stillness, the flat dam, is met by activity, the wind, it resolves in rhythm. So we have this stationary part, the nerve sense system, we have a metabolic limb system, and we have a rhythmic system. And they all belong to three different lawfulnesses, so to speak. So what Rudolf Steiner said, that that's in a way the model for us to think about the social life, or the how community life, so to speak. Because there are some things, in the realm of ideas, in the cultural realm, as we call it, that's where total freedom is appropriate and expected. You don't expect people to agree in the realm of ideas, so to speak. Everyone will bring their own ideas to the table. And then if it works herd, so to speak, and sorted, and then it comes down to how do those ideas actually come into practice? And that's where you move to the what we call the economic realm, which is the sort of like the metabolic limb system, because you can have great ideas, but they've got to be practical. They've got to be doable in the physical world. So in the realm of ideas, total freedom, you can create whatever fantasy you like. But when it comes to actually building something, it's got to be practical. And so that requires a different skill base. And in a certain sense, in the economic or the metabolic limb system, there is absolutely no freedom. A brick is a brick, and you can't dream it to be a stone or a butterfly or whatever. That's just, so you have to deal with the physical reality of the world and the laws of mechanics. If you're going to build a bridge or a house or whatever, there's no freedom in that. The design of the house, absolutely. But when you translate that into an architectural design, the freedom goes. And then the middle sphere is where decisions get made. And so if it's a house, you can go to an architect who'll give you an idea. You can go to the builder who'll tell you what it's going to cost. And then you sit down and you as the owner have to balance the idealism of your dream as articulated by the architect and the reality that the builder is going to manifest. And so for the social life to work, you have to have it so people have freedom in the thinking, and competence in the doing, and then when the idea has been clarified and the physical reality has been clarified, then you can take it to the community to vote on, so to speak. And there, everyone is equal. They can have 10 PhDs, or they can be a Darrow on the street. We're all equal human beings in the middle realm. We all have a, we all of those of everyone who's going to be affected by the decision should be part of the decision. So that's how we move towards individuality becoming social.
Great. And do you teach all this in your workshops? Is that part of your training?
It's seeded into every workshop I do, put it that way. It depends on who's there, but most of my workshops focus on the biodynamics, and in that, my objective is to give people an idea of biodynamics, why, what, and all that sort of stuff. And then the second part of the workshops is actually physically doing everything they'll need to do when they go home if they want to apply it. Yeah, but seeded into that whole process is what I've been talking about. Yeah. I also do separate workshops on threefolding and things like that, but I was the founding chairman of the Biodynamic Association in Bellingen back in the 80s, and then I went overseas for a few years and came back and somehow got involved again. But then I became the CEO for a few years, and what we were setting up there was a practical model of that threefolding. But like all these things, these are not so easy because new ideas are difficult for people to grasp. And we ended up with a board who didn't want to go down that path, so that all dissolved. Yeah. So it's still in Australia, it's still something that needs to be brought into being, so to speak.
That's interesting. And I know that you grew up in a property in Braidwood. And how did that early life shape your understanding of soil farming and life itself?
Well, first of all, I have to say, I can't be more grateful to my father or my parents, but my father, who had a very top end of town job in Sydney. I was born in Sydney, and then when I was one, we moved to Melbourne. So he had a very, top of the range job. And when I was about five, he tossed all that in and bought a farm near Exeter, near Moss Vale on the Southern Highlands. And so from the age of five, I've lived on a farm, and I couldn't be more grateful. I can't imagine growing up in Sydney or Melbourne, having had the life I've had. And so it influenced me greatly, more than I knew at the time, put it that way. And as I now sort of look out and see how few children grow up on farms, it's not just a tragedy, it's a disaster waiting to happen. Because, I mean, if you look at the valley you're living in, or I don't know how far up the valley you are, but all these valleys up and down the north coast, excuse me, and also the south coast, were all dairy farms. And, they milked 20, 30 cows. Most people had 3 to 5 to 10 kids. So there's a massive number of my generation who actually grew up in the country, and that's no longer happening. And I think it's going to be it's we're starting to see the I'm not quite sure how even to describe it, just lack of common sense that modern kids have. And it's not inherently the kids, it's just when you have to deal with cows or horses or chooks or pigs or grasshoppers, whatever it is, you develop a certain subliminal capacity or common sense. And these kids who just have iPhones and every gadget that you can imagine. My grandson's sort of first or third birthday, my son came back with these two black bags of junk toys that the parents from the preschool thing had sort of all turned up with a present, but they were just junk, and that's I don't know how we get around that. I'm not criticizing it, well, I am, but I'm criticizing in the sense I just don't know how we get around it, and I try and imagine what it's like to be a kid today, because like television didn't happen in Australia until I was about 10, and we didn't have one in our family until I was about 15. So, if you try and imagine that today, parents would go spare if they had to entertain their kids or have their, like, it's not the parents that entertained us. They kicked us out the door and we went and played in the bush. And came home at dark, sort of stuff. This helicopter parenting now is that it's I really feel for both the parents and the children.
Yeah, the same. Like we grew up playing on the streets in Wales in the UK, and everybody was safe, and all the neighbours would look out. And if my mum went out and said, "I haven't seen Beverly," they'd go, "Oh, she's playing in the stream." You know, the people know where you are, and it was safe. And as we've been travelling around, and before we bought the land, we went to visit many farmers. And like, when you're in the middle of nowhere, you have to be connected to the land. Like, we're just in cows now, and they're calving. And yesterday, one of the cows, you know, had a prolapse after birth, and of course, all of a sudden, the farmer is now the midwife's, you know, putting the prolapse back in and so forth. And yeah, and I think last time I was in Melbourne, it was such a treat. We went to an urban city farm called Ceres, Ceres, and it
I've
was
been there.
lovely. Yeah. It's lovely, like it gives the children. And the reason I mention it, because my mother-in-law's neighbor's got two small boys, and she said, "I'm determined to take them to land so they can feel land and see animals and so forth." And if she's not taking them there, and it's lovely that the community's involved and can grow food, etc., and see the animals. She goes on farmsteads, and some of them let them watch. The kids watch the cows being milked and so forth, and you're seeing the chickens laying eggs and
That's all fantastic, but the part that people miss, you just described a cow having calving problems and the prolapse, etc. But you see, we as kids would have been there through that process, so we would be learning on site what to do in these situations. Because you watch and you learn, and eventually, you're it. Your father's away or something, and something happens, and you're it. And it's a sort of natural process in a certain way. Okay, this friend of ours was working with trouble. Was working in Sydney, and then I went back to the family farm at Braidwood for a while, and this friend of ours was working with troubled youth, teenage youth. And he asked if he could bring some of them to camp. And we had a shack up the back on the back creek. So I said, yeah, absolutely. And the one rule was that they couldn't touch the animals. So 2 days into this exercise, I got a call on the radio because we didn't have mobile phones in those days. And radio between the vehicles was pretty new too. But anyway, I got a call on the radio that they'd actually been jumping on the sheep and they'd broken a sheep's back. And so
Oh.
I got in the Land Cruiser and went to the slaughterhouse and got the killing knives and set off and got to where they were. And I made them cut its throat. and skin it and butcher it and do the whole thing. And at first they were pretty shocked with what had happened, and they were terrified to touch these knives, etc. But we took them through the process, and so at the end there was a butchered sheep that we could actually eat, so to speak. Anyway, 2 days later, the lambs had got back into the ewes. We'd weaned the lambs, and something happened. So I got all these kids, and they were in the yards catching sort of 40-kilo lambs and throwing them on the back of the back of the ute, so to speak. And they loved it, And
Wow.
that's the sort of thing that, and today, and even probably then, that's a very dangerous thing for a farmer to do, because if one of those kids has got damaged in any way, shape, or form, you can lose the farm. So we have a whole lot of
Wow.
insurance type issues that mitigate against that sort of learning. And anyone who's grown up on a farm, it's not an accident-free place. A cow can kick you, a horse can kick you, you can fall off a horse, you can fall off a motorbike. It's not risk-free. But we're trying to create a world, and the insurance is trying to sort of force upon us a world that is as actually risk-free, and that's not how life is. So I don't know how we beat that one. All I can say in hindsight was we were lucky. Nothing
Yeah.
happened.
Well, a couple of weeks ago, you mentioned the word lucky. Brian and I, because we were just in the neighbor's cows, as I mentioned, we could hear a cow making weird noises. And he told us sometimes when they're giving birth, they isolate themselves and make a weird noise. And I seen one crying by the tree. Anyway, we went down because I couldn't see the calf anywhere. And then he was in the creek. He dropped 1.5 meters to a steep drop. When he was being given birth, the placenta was still on the ridge and the calf had gone straight in. And we knew it was important that he bonds with his mum and also get licked for the circulation and nervous system. But that bonding and needing to drink the milk, we knew physically, just having a quick glance, we thought, okay, he must be all right. He'd managed to stand up. Or she managed to stand up the little calf and was making sounds. But because of all the stones and the cold water, she couldn't walk to the edge. So Brian quickly jumped in and picked him out in two ledges and we reconnected them. And the farmer was so grateful because if we hadn't been there the year before, a similar thing had happened and the calf had drowned in the stream. So, it's having that knowing, I think you don't know what life is unless you experience it. And here you're in touch with nature because you're hearing the birds and all different types of animals in the nature. But yeah, as you said, it's a shame. And it was a good news story for those young boys to have that experience that came to your farm. And yeah, on another level, because I know my friend Vicky said that she knew you from your Demeter bakery days in Sydney, and I believe you have Pioneer biodynamic whole grain breads. And yeah, how did those early days of baking ignite your passion for nutrition and holistic health?
Well, Vicky's very kind. I didn't actually start the bakery. That was the work of Irwin Burney, and that was 1972. And if you think back to 1972 and the idea of buying brown bread in Australia, really the only brown bread you could buy was dyed white bread, these square things, or wog bread from the back streets of Marrickville, these new Australians with their strange eating habits, sort of thing. So Riga bread, Riga was quite a famous bakery that came out of that stream. So Irwin, he was a photographer by profession, And he went to Europe, studying some of Steiner's work. And someone asked him in Europe about getting biodynamic wheat grain there because they were short. And Erwin didn't know anything about it, so he came back and made some inquiries and found that yes, it was being grown. David Williams up at Breezer, and but he couldn't work. The rules about exporting were too difficult, and so he thought, well, if this is so special, so he started buying a bit of grain and baking bread at home and doing that sort of thing, and then. It grew to the point where he went to Butler's Bakery in Northbridge in Sydney and asked if he could use their bakery during the day when they weren't using it. So for a number of years, that's how it happened. We used the brick ovens of Butler's Bakery, and they used to bake at night and we'd bake in the day. And so we'd bake one day and deliver the next. So that was not it began in 1972, and I was working in the wool broking business at the time, and I got transferred to Sydney in 1975. So in 1976, I jumped ship from wool broking to baking, and I'd never baked a loaf of bread in my life, but that was the beginning of a new journey. Yeah. So, and it was very
Yeah, no.
exciting, you know.
Yeah, what challenges and breakthroughs did you experience during that time?
Well, first of all, I have to say that the bread we baked, no one is baking anymore. It was a fermentation process, quite similar to a da sourdough bread. So, as I say, 1972, the only brown bread you could buy was strange bread. Now you can buy sourdough, wholemeal bread all over the country, but it's sourdough. And we had a ferment process that came out of, again, it came out of Steiner's work. It's different to sourdough. The sourdough, you take a bit of the today's dough that you don't bake, and that becomes the starter for the next one. So it's a ongoing process, and from a sort of what you might call a spiritual nutrition point of view, that has. Every sourdough has ancestry, so to speak. So you can look at that culture that Iron Father Abraham or one, where everything is coming down through the bloodline. And part of this time of individuality, we've got to break the bloodline connections, so to speak. And so the sourdough or the ferment bread we made, each batch, was made from a new starter, so to speak. So it had no ancestry. So as a foundation for individuality, we're bringing that right down into the bread. And that bakery stopped working in the 1990s. I'd moved away by then, but it still troubles me that we haven't gone back to doing it. So maybe that's still ahead of me to go back to that. Because
Well, you've
this is a dimension of biodynamics and nutrition that is not yet understood, and I've lived long enough that you can't bring everything about at once, so to speak. It's a process of stepping people towards something. If you try and go too extreme, then it's too much for people. So I've sort of backed off a bit, but I probably shouldn't.
Well, like you say, it's about people being ready as well, because a 7-year-old, 21-year-old, 56-year-old, it's all about divine timing. And when people are ready, I say to my students, when the student's ready, the master appears. And I'm sure it will happen. And at that lovely event with Dan Kittredge, Charlie Arnott was there, and I know you're collaborating with Charlie with regenerative farming. What excites you the most about the future of Australian agriculture?
There's an amazing book called The Diary of a Welsh Swagman. And this guy was Welsh, obviously, and he was an award-winning farmer and poet, as Welsh people tend to be. And he decided, I think it was in about the 1860s, he decided he wanted to know what was going on in the Antipodes. So he sort of passed the farm on to his son and left his wife at home and set off for Australia. And for 25 years, he was a sort of basically swaggy in Australia, mainly around Castlemaine in Victoria. And he was one of the few people that came to Australia as knowledgeable farmers. And he didn't own a farm, he worked on farms. And and he'd kept a diary all his life. So that's how this sort of came to light. But he was horrified, in how fast people were killing the soil, just mining the soil. And one description, he said, these guys don't even know how to deal with horses, because in Wales they'd work the horses through the appropriate seasons, and then they'd let them loose in the hills to rejuvenate, so to speak. And he said he was seeing people who the horses would die in the traces. These people had no idea how to look after, even in a European style, they had no idea, because most of them had no farming background at all when they came here. And the depletion of the soil over a period of 6 years, he said, was just horrendous. And Leichhardt was the same. Some of Australia's soils, Leichhardt measured, they had organic matter of over 30%. Now, if you've got more than 5%, 0.5% organic matter, you're doing well. So to answer your question, I'm totally confident we can bring the Australian landscape back to what it was when white man came here. That to me is what we need to do, and I'm totally confident it can be done. Whether we'll do it or not as Australians, that's a separate question. But my whole mission has been, we've got to make the skills available, so if people want to do it, they can do it. So that's what biodynamics means for me, that we can actually do it, and I've seen people do it. So it's not a theory. And if I say people like Ray and Judy Unger out near Peak Hill, south of Dubbo, very awesome, what you might call ordinary farmers, but extraordinary people. And they won the prize for the best flock of ewes in the central west of New South Wales recently. And they've got soil, they've got grain, they've got meat, they've got wool, all of high quality, and they sit there and in a way choose who they sell to, so to speak. But they've got their soil and their farm where it should be or where it could be. And if they can do it, it's doable for anyone who just applies themselves, and with a bit of intelligence and a lot of will. And in their case, mutual support. They work as a great team. And there are a number of farmers around Australia who are doing really well. No inputs other than what they do themselves, and are very happy, contented people. So, it's not a theory. People are doing it. It's a choice.
Yes, having been blessed to talk to many farmers and scientists, I know there's many people doing it, and I've physically been on many farms and seen the difference. And recently interviewed Dr. Mary Cole, who's, she's one of Australia's top soil scientists, and on her farm, she's been there 53 years, and Everything is natural, and the yield is probably 5% more than most other farmers, like the couple that you were talking about. Anyway, on your site, it also links to articles like glyphosate and its long-term impact on soil health and soil carbon. So, how much of your current focus is on remedying the past chemical damage?
I don't particularly focus on it. I'm more focused on the positive, but I do know that if we get biodynamic agriculture particularly going, it will overcome those things in time, depending on how bad it is. And the other thing I'm trying to encourage people to use is the horn silica, the silica preparation we use, which was an it's an atmospheric spray, and I'm hoping that we'll get to the stage where we can use that as a desiccant instead of glyphosate, so we can actually help reduce the water, the moisture in plants for harvest time, and at the same time increase the quality, because the horn silica, if it's put out, up 48 hours before harvest, you can really up the protein levels or the BOMI in wine or what have you quite significantly in a very short time. So if we can do that as well as have a desiccant effect, it's certainly much cheaper and certainly much better and much healthier for the consumer of the food and for the soil. So that's one of the aspects that I'm hoping to that will evolve into the future. The other thing I should say that still is ahead of us is that my father and uncle basically pioneered superphosphate into the Braidwood district, and it worked well for some time from their perspective. They got greater yields and blah blah blah. But they weren't sharp enough to connect a lot of the problems that came with it, like pyotosis and worms and all sorts of stuff. So my brother was the one that actually took us in a different direction. In Rudolf Steiner's lectures, he talks about the fact that it's a solution. And so he's saying mineral fertilizers is not a solution, because mineral fertilizers really only nourish the watery part of the plant. And so anyone who uses chemical agriculture, while the season's good, things can appear to go all right. But if the season goes against you, it's very tough on plants, where once you've got a good biodynamic soil, you're more resilient in good seasons and bad. So the point of this part is to say that I met a farmer. He crops 5,000 acres down Victoria, and he's been using biological for 10 years, he tells me, and he says it's not working anymore. It's not doing what it used to do. And that fascinates me, because that's what I've been anticipating, that if you just inoculate with microbes, that's not going to be enough. It'll give you a short-term fix, like superphosphate gives you a short-term fix, but actually it's not going to be the answer. And so with this whole move to regen ag, which I'm totally supportive of, I think it's fantastic, but if people just inoculate with microbes, because we all agree microbes should be in the soil, but the way Steiner puts it, if you want flies in the room, you can bring a jar of flies in and let them loose, and they'll look around and decide whether they stay or go. The other way is just to put a bit of rotten meat in the room, and the flies that are relevant to that piece of meat, will appear out of nowhere. And I remember in 1966, I was out in Central Australia, out near Uluru, and we'd been driving for 5 hours, and we got out to have a break, and within seconds we were swarmed with flies. They're there. They'll come out of nowhere. And so it is with the microbes. We don't actually have to put them there. We have to create the conditions under which they want to be there. And that's what differentiates biodynamics from most of the sort of microbe-focused people. We all agree on the outcome. We want microbes, no question. But actually, just inoculating with microbes will end up in a similar, similar but different outcome to superphosphate. So biodynamics, that's where we've got to, by bringing the big picture, the cosmic picture in, and bringing the relationship of the earthly to the cosmic, so that the microbes and all the right life forms, can arrive on your farm. That's what it's about, not by inoculation.
Yeah, I totally agree from what the scientists are saying. It's like anything in life, you need that biodiversity, not monocultures and mono anything. So that was wonderful. And what advice can you give to new farmers like myself or home gardeners, for example, starting off?
Look, it sounds trite. Get the biodynamic preparations out. Get the soil preparation, the Horn Manure 500, stir it, put it out. Get the silica one, stir it and put it out. If you're making compost, put the compost preparations in. It's as simple as that. And, so often people ring up and they're involved in the biodynamics and they've got problems, and you say, have you put the preparations out? Have you used the compost preparations? Have you used the silica? And too often they just haven't got around to it. And so just do the basics. They're not difficult to do. They're very simple to do. And you will be surprised at the outcome. Like it's individual everywhere, but if you want to trial it, just put it out on half a paddock and see where the animals graze. My brother doesn't shut, well, he doesn't farm anymore, but he didn't shut the front gate because the sheep didn't want to leave.
Ah.
So it's the animals that will tell you that it's working, or your family, taste the food. It's very simple, and it's, I always say, it's like meditation. It's dead easy until you start to do it. Then it's that getting yourself into the rhythm of it, getting yourself into the practice. That is the hard part. You don't need any special tools, or like you need a bucket and some Horn Manure. That's not difficult to come by. But as I said, it's like meditation. It's really it's just a matter of sitting down and doing it, so to speak. And
Great.
the results will be what you make of it.
Thank you. And I'll be giving it an extra daily dose of love every day. So, as this is a health and wellness show, what is your health and wellness go-to? Something you like to do every day to keep you in balance?
Oh, well, I start my day with doing some eurythmy every morning. Eurythmy is a movement. It's always very difficult, especially for a non-professional, to describe it, but it's like visible speech. And essentially, I think I mentioned right at the beginning, I worked with a medical facility in England for 5 years. We got Mental Health Practice of the Year Award in 1995 at the Blackthorn Trust. And we had a garden and bakery and cafe out in the back, which is where I was. And this eurythmy, it's a form of movement. And I described earlier, the human being is made of a physical body, an etheric body, an astral body, and an ego. And as I've described, each of those bodies operate also under a different lawfulness, just on terms of consciousness. We have an I am consciousness. We have an individuality consciousness. The astral body, which we share with the animal kingdom, that's where our sympathies and antipathies arise. So the animal has sympathies and antipathies, so to speak. It runs towards what it likes and away from what it doesn't like. It hasn't got its own individual controlling I am. So its consciousness is the same as a human being in a dreaming sleep. And if you look into a cow's eyes or a horse's eye, and imagine, it's like they're looking like you'd be looking out in a dream, so to speak. So we share that consciousness with the animals. The plants, we share with the a consciousness with the plants that's the equivalent of the human being in a dreamless sleep. And when I was in boarding school, we were doing Twelfth Night as the school play, and the guy who had the task of the role of Malvolio started to sleep talk, and the guy in the next bed was a real wag. So this guy had started mutter his sort of Malvolio role. So his next door neighbour got the whole he got the text for the whole of Twelfth Night, is it? And took this guy through his role as Malvolio, totally asleep. He was sound asleep, but he could go through his part in Malvolio, which says that he'd actually taken it into his etheric body, because that's where we our memory that's where our memories live, in our etheric body. Yeah. And so that's the body of formative force. And so with eurythmy, that becomes the healing body, so to speak. And eurythmy is working with bodily movements that nourish that etheric body in a way that makes it sort of conform with the organs. And so by doing that sort of movement, you can actually I've witnessed amazing healing with when you've got a eurythmist who knows what they're doing. It's extraordinary stuff. So I start with that every morning. And I also, I'm not fanatical about food, but we buy the best we can get. Yeah. And that's an important thing to do, because we're only going to encourage, regenerative, biodynamic, organic agriculture, syntropic, whatever, if we buy the produce. Yeah. So the consumers will create the future, not the government. If we choose to buy good food, then growers will grow good food.
That's great advice. And is there one thing, if there was one thing you could do to change or to make the world a better place, what would it be?
Look, this is something I'm not good at, but I think the power of meditation is more than most people realize. Yeah. And so
Yeah.
in the First World War, people said to Steiner, "What can we do?" And he said, "Understand what's happening." Yeah. And I think if meditation, but
Yeah.
understand what's happening. One of the joys of my sort of current situation is that I travel a lot. And I listen to podcasts, and there are amazing podcasts out there on all sorts of subjects. And I listen to podcasts. A lot of them I don't agree with what they're saying, or I don't like the way they do it, but it's amazing. They interview interesting people, and I learn, I sometimes learn more from the people I don't like than the people I do like.
The joys of having a curious mind. So I on
Yeah,
that note,
but I'm blessed with having come across Anthroposophy, because that I think if I hadn't come across Anthroposophy, I'd be in the sort of lineup to become a terrorist. Yeah, but and I had a very good education, didn't make sense, and my since coming across Anthroposophy when I was 24, I've spent the rest of my life basically making sense of those years that didn't make sense. So I'm very grateful for what Stein has offered us.
fabulous. I've got a few friends studying it at the moment, and I'm sure they're going to be delighted to hear what you've just said. And on that note, I'd like to thank you so much for your words of wisdom and all the wonderful insights and information you shared. I've got lots to look up on a personal level, especially the Diary of a Welsh Swagman and Eurythmia. I know I'm saying it wrong. And yeah, just following your tips to get my soil health started. So thank you, and I'll put your website biodynamics2024.com.au with the show notes. And
Thank you.
yeah, thank you for everything.
Okay. Well, send me your address and I'll send you some preparations to get you started.
Thank you very much. And to the listeners, I hope you've taken notes, and whether you've got a farm or a backyard, I know that you'll benefit from this chat and all the words of wisdom, human vision to make our planet much healthier. Thank you.